massive show for you here today as Ben Gretsch joins to discuss rankings, projections, how we go about building these things, and some of the faulty ways that we build this thing, and how chaos truly rules fantasy analysis. Where do you see mistakes in fantasy analysis when it comes to applying data to specific situations? And where are some of the situations the community might be wrong this year? Drake London, Jackson Smith and Jigba, Javonte Williams, tons of players you can benefit from in drafts this year. Let's get into it. It's Thursday, August 8th. I'm Matt Harmon. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Forecast. It is a hell of a day to talk ball. Actually, it's a horrible day to talk ball because this morning, as we're taping this, August 7th, Josh Downs sustained a high ankle sprain in practice. So actually, it is a terrible day to talk ball, but I'm hoping that it's going to become a lot better here, because joining me to talk a little ball is the one and only Ben Gretsch of the Stealing Signals Substack. Ben, what's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. Excited to join you. We got a fun topic today. Yeah, the injuries are starting coming from camp. It's that reminder that the whole offseason is so fun to think about all this like positive stuff. And then this time of year, you're like, man, there's so much stuff that's going to go differently than we're hoping for.
Yes, 100%. I definitely had a moment when 5 to 6 people sent me the Josh Downs tweet this morning before the day has really even truly begun. I always say, if you're a person that's trying to focus on your health, the one time in the morning that is truly yours that cannot be disrupted is that early morning time. Well, apparently it can be disrupted when the Colts have practiced super early, and then and one of your favorite little receivers, the defender tackles him in a 7-on-7. I thought about that as soon as that news broke, Ben, because now I'm like, I can already hear myself, and I'm being so fatalistic about this, but I can already hear myself in January when people are like, hey, what happened to Josh Downs? I thought you said Josh Downs is going to be good. I'm like, well, he had a high ankle sprain in camp. What do you think? Like,
yeah.
It ruined his
really
whole season.
Tough to come back from. Yeah. It's brutal, man. The injuries to the players, the injuries to teammates. I mean, this all is going to kind of dovetail with a lot of the stuff we want to talk about today, but it changes the assumptions that we're making when we're starting to do projections and think through things in the summer. All of it is, is just a spiral now, right? From here till week 1, and then from week 1 till week 17, right? It's all, everything that we thought we knew is going to change from here on out.
Yeah, you're right. It does perfectly dovetail to a lot of our conversations today, which is why I wanted to have Ben on the show, because this is rankings week. We're doing a lot of thinking about rankings and projections. And when we do these things, I think it's important to think about what we get wrong. And I mean fantasy analysts, because you're going to hear a ton of fantasy analysis this month. Some of you are probably just tuning back into the NFL. Welcome and congratulations on having a normal life. That sounds wonderful. But you're going to hear a lot of fantasy analysis this month, and a lot of it is going to be wrong. A lot of it is not intentionally wrong. Some of it may be misguided. I'm going to do some of that misguided stuff on this podcast. Ben is great at this. Ben's one of my favorite people in the industry, but he's going to get things wrong. We're all going to, miss here. And I think it's important to sort of think about how those misses happen. So that's what the topic today is: projections versus rankings and what fantasy analysis gets wrong. But before we do that, I do have a programming note for you. Like I said, you're consuming a ton of fantasy content this month because it's fantasy draft month. So sign up for Yahoo Fantasy Football League right now if you haven't already. I mean, come on. What are you doing? Like I say, let's get this thing going. Okay, this is the time of the year. If that's not a good enough reason, I have one more reason for you. Yahoo Sports and NBC are teaming up for a $1 million sweepstakes, and here's how you enter. Sign up for a private Yahoo Fantasy Football League and draft your team. You're going to do that anyways after I just told you to do it. Now, if any of those players you start scores a touchdown in the week 1 games on NBC and Peacock, you're going to earn bonus entries into the sweepstakes. A lot of great teams to pick from: Chiefs, Lions, Rams, Packers, Eagles, Ravens. Great teams there. Each person can earn up to 8 entries in the sweepstakes, 1 for signing up and up to 7 more for touchdowns scored in those 3 games. The deadline for entries is September 5th. So visit yahoo.com/fantasymillion to join. All right. Speaking of drafting, a lot of you are doing that this month. Like I said, this is rankings week. So Ben, I wanted to have this conversation with you because I love the way you approach projections. I think it's a good way to start this discussion before we get into kind of what fantasy analysis gets wrong. So when you're creating your projections in the offseason, and like you said at the top, painting this pretty little picture of how we think everything is going to happen, which will eventually be turned to dust in one way or another. Kind of walk me through your process of the top level all the way down to the player level when you're doing projections.
Yeah, I mean, it starts at the team level. I'm looking at pass rate over expected. I'm looking at coaching trends. And when I talk about pass rate over expected, you're obviously having an expected pass rate in that scenario, which is going to be relative to whether teams are leading or trailing in games. And so one of the ways I start for a 2024 projection is to look at like Vegas win totals, get an assumption of expected pass rate, and then start to think through, okay, is this team from a coaching trend standpoint more or less pass heavy? How fast do they play? How does their pace play into their play volume? Pace being like time to snap. And so you do all this top level stuff and you get pass attempts and you get running attempts. And then you have to dole it all out to the players and project their usage, their efficiency. And then all of that has to, especially the receiving stuff, has to come back onto the quarterback and add up neatly, right? And then the quarterback stuff at the end, I'm always going back and going, okay, I projected all the skill players. What does this mean for the quarterback? In some cases, I'll be way off some of their historical numbers, right? I'm projecting too high of an ADOT. I'm projecting too much efficiency for a certain quarterback. And then I have to ask some real tough questions. Do I think the situation is the best that quarterback's going to be playing in? Do I think he has the potential for a career high in efficiency? Or do I have to go back and look at the receivers and say, these guys are going to have a tougher time because the quarterback plays a lot different than when they compiled this past data? I mean, a great example of a team that this happened with for me was the Minnesota Vikings. As well as everyone loves Justin, I love Justin Jefferson. TJ Hawkinson's been hyper efficient in this offense the last couple of years, particularly like on catch rate and when you control for his low ADOT. Jordan Addison, really efficient rookie season, right? You do all that, you get to the end, and you have a rookie quarterback and Sam Darnold that you're kind of projecting both for, and you're like, wow, the yards per attempt I'm projecting here is like way above Sam Darnold's career number. There's some questions here. Am I going to scale back Justin Jefferson, or is Justin Jefferson going to bring Sam Darnold and or this rookie quarterback along? It's a different conversation. I think we all sort of expect at least some type of a drop off from what Kirk Cousins was. And he's a guy who, you know, is going to target receivers, throw a lot of catchable targets to receivers and be friendly to receiving weapons. At the same time, Justin Jefferson is elite, right? And so there's, you know, like how much of it is where this old efficiency, how much of that do we carry over into the new situation?
Yeah, that's a great way of starting and a great example too, because I struggled with that with doing my projections, specifically the Minnesota Vikings. And Ben's projections are much more detailed than mine, which I could have told you before this, and I can definitely tell you after him just answering that question. I'm trying to just get a rough look at things because I'm doing a lot of other things. I don't have time to do the granular projections as much as Ben is doing, which is awesome that we have people doing this better than me. That is for sure. But I struggled with the same thing with the Minnesota Vikings because it's really hard. These are the situations, Ben, to me, that are most difficult to project, which is the how do I parse out what is Kirk Cousins and how do I parse out what is Kevin O'Connell? Because I had the same thing where I'm projecting initially the Vikings to be a lot more pass heavy than I think they're either going to be with journeyman Sam Darnold or rookie JJ McCarthy. Like, I don't believe either of those things. So when we're in, honestly, same thing for when I'm doing the Falcons projections, adding Kirk Cousins, how much of what happened in Minnesota is the way they want to play football and how much of that is Kirk Cousins? And we get these narratives all the time, you know, oh, this guy likes to target this position. This guy, Russell Wilson and his tight ends or something like that. There's always narratives about that stuff. But how much of that is the offense that they're coming from and how much of that is the player? I think that's one of the more difficult things to parse out in projections is what's the team, what's the offense, and what is the quarterback preference? And honestly, when do those things meet in the middle?
Yeah, and I think the biggest part of it comes down to, as I've done this over the years, the biggest thing that I have learned from it is that I don't want to be too tethered to past outcomes. Like I do want that stuff to inform it, but I'm projecting a season that we haven't seen yet. I'm predicting the future, which is inherently going to be flawed, right? I have no idea what's going to happen. And particularly when it comes to football, which is a sport that is influenced by every snap is influenced by 22 people moving at the same time, right? It's not just a pitcher versus a hitter, like in baseball, where we can isolate some things. And then also it's influenced by injuries and attrition and a lot of the things that we know about the sport. It's a very physical sport and the way things can change over the course of a year, let alone the fact that it's so schematic and tactical and coaches are hiding all of that. There's so many things we're going to learn in week one that we're like, oh, wow, this team looks way different than we were expecting, because that does happen every year as well. Teams have stuff that they're ready for, that they're ready for, that we're not ready for, right? That they've been practicing, that they're doing things differently. And we have great beat reporters that are trying to figure that stuff out at camp and all that. But their job is to make sure that basically their reporters aren't reporting that. There's always a push and pull where they're like, we don't want you to tell too much of the details out of camp, because we don't want everyone to be prepared for what we're planning to do this season or in this particular game on a weekly level or what have you. There's always the subterfuge in football. And so it's really challenging. The way I always describe it with projections, especially seasonal projections, is it's a moving target. I once in an article used that that show Loki as an example, where they have the timelines and there's branches on the timelines, but it's like branches and then branches off those branches. Like the Aaron Rodgers injury last year changed the whole projection for the Jets. If I would have known that Aaron Rodgers wasn't in the offense, I would have had a different baseline of efficiency for their offense, like we were just talking about. Like my projection for Garrett Wilson assumed that the quarterback was going to be someone who could be efficient and elevate him, as opposed to Zach Wilson for the majority of the season, and then Trevor Siemian and some other names there that changed the way that you would have to assume that Garrett Wilson could score in fantasy, because that quarterback play matters so much. And that's just one specific easy example. But when I've looked at this in the past, I backtested, not this offseason, but last offseason, I backtested my 2022 projections just on the team volume level. So the total plays, pass attempts, and rush attempts, three main categories. And I did the same exercise back when I was at CBS in like 2019. And in both cases, for about half the league, for about 16 of the 32 teams, I was off by either 50 pass or run plays or 100 total plays, one of those categories, which is a massive amount of volume. The scale of from lowest to highest is not that much larger than that. When you think, you know, plus or minus 50 is 100, and the plus or minus from the lowest to the highest in some of these stats is only a couple hundred, you know, for league wide. And so a lot of these teams, the assumptions we're making, even just on the top level about the total team volume, is going to be wrong. And it's for more teams than I think people assume. It's in my back testing, roughly half the league, right? And that doesn't mean we don't try to predict the team. It's typically the teams like the Aaron Rodgers situation I just described last year, or Anthony Richardson getting hurt early, and suddenly you have Gardner Minshew, more of a drop back and get the ball out passer, used to play in the air raid in college, compared to a mobile quarterback. That's going to change pass volume, right? That's going to change how many drop backs actually become pass attempts, in addition to probably called pass rate and all these elements. And so these assumptions we are making, we do have to understand that we're trying to get as close as we can so that we can make informed decisions in our drafts, but we're also going to be wrong. And that is an important part for developing a draft strategy, is that we can't assume that projections are going to be perfectly accurate. You said I'm somebody who spends a lot of time on them, and I'm also somebody who will tell you that they're not gospel, right? They're not something that's going to tell us exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, a couple of good examples from last year, even on teams. The Aaron Rodgers one is an extreme one that obviously week one happens, and Anthony Richardson, I think, to the same degree later in the season. The injury happens and it changes your entire projections. These two examples I'm going to give are maybe a little bit more minute ones, but they're smaller. But at the same time, I think they were both cataclysmic changes for the structure of two teams that had the same coach, same play caller, and the same quarterback. And that was the Los Angeles Rams and the Miami Dolphins. Dolphins, week one, they come out with all of this cheat motion, the full speed motion at the snap. Everybody's talking about it throughout the course of the season, especially after week one. But there was, and look, I hesitate to say there was nobody talking about it, because everybody's talking about something these days when we're covering football, because it's such an in-depth sport. But I don't remember a lot of like, hey, you're never going to believe what the Miami Dolphins are going to crank out in week one. That was a totally unforeseen development. And that is very much on the margins. But I don't know how you could take into account of that in like projections or anything. But I would say the Rams one is maybe even a more extreme example, where what the Rams have always been under Sean McVay are an outside zone, threaten the edge, run team. And then by the middle of the season, they've fully gone on into this duo power run identity, which was perfect for Kyren Williams, who was, you know, like a last round pick in best ball, a waiver wire hero early on. And, you know, the Rams have a ton of great beat writers and a ton of great people covering that team, but there was no indication that the Rams were going to be that team. And hell, I'll go one step further. I'm not even sure the Rams knew they were going to be that team at the start of the season. It was something that, hey, this is working well. Let's continue to emphasize it and lean into it. So all of these assumptions we have in the offseason, and really even like right before the season, can just I mean, listen to all of our podcasts going into week one, but they can go completely out of the window as soon as the real games start happening.
Yeah, those examples are great ones, because the only way I can think that you could have gotten to layering that into projections or rankings is just to really more vaguely be like, I'm in on these coaches. I think Mike McDaniel will do good things, smart things to put his players into good positions. Same thing with McVay. I think he'll fit his scheme to his talent, not the opposite way, which some coaches have a tendency to try to fit their talent to their scheme. It's one of the things I don't love about Arthur Smith, for example. I feel like he tries to get his players to do exactly what he needs them to do, as opposed to you just describe Sean McVay. This is my running back, and this is what his skill set is, and I'm gonna change my whole running scheme to fit his skill set. And it really worked out for them, and he's been able to build off of that. That doesn't mean that your understanding of a coach's, I guess, innovativeness or whatever that word is the only factor. We're layering in all sorts of different factors, right? Like, Sean McVay couldn't do it all in 2022 when Matthew Stafford and Cooper Kupp both got hurt and he was trying to play Baker Mayfield down the stretch. You can't just find answers when you don't have talent as well. So we still have to go back to, like, talent is going to probably rise to the top, right? Like, great players are going to make great plays, period. It's a lot of different important things. I always go back to this thing that both of our buddy, Rich Rebar, longtime awesome analyst with Sharp Football, used this phrase probably 10 years ago that I've always gone back to, that it's all these tools that we have on our tool belt, right? Like, we're always like, there's this and there's that and there's that, and this is why I'm going to come to the conclusion I am. And to me, projections are one of those tools. Like, it's one example or one team level outcome for how the season might go. And it's a good, you know, we sometimes call it the median, but it's not the median for every player. Cause when we start talking about, like, handcuff running backs, there's a question of, well, we can't project much volume for them, or we're starting to cut into the starters' workload. And really, like, when I do my projections, I do them as more of like I assume health, and I do them more like a 60th percentile outcome, like a better than average outcome, where I'm assuming things go right for the team. And that's how I try to think through it. And then I also have to layer in intuition on what could go wrong, and what does that mean, and how does that change things. And so for a player like a handcuff running back, I won't look at his projection at all, because it's not relevant to me what Blake Corum comes out in a projection to follow the Rams example. I can look at Sean McVay's tendencies and feel fairly confident that they have at least the potential to go with a workhorse, or they might give Kyren a little more time off, which they've talked about this year. But in either case, Corum's either going to have some standalone value or be a really high profile handcuff if Kyren does miss some time, where if you're saying they're going to continue to be very extreme with their snap shares, because Kyren had the second highest average snap share among running backs last year behind only McCaffrey. If they're going to continue to be that extreme, which some reports say they aren't, that means that if Kyren misses time, Corum's probably going to be that extreme too. And that makes him a really, really high profile play. So both those directions, I'm like, okay, kind of like Blake Corum. But that's not something a projection is going to tell me. It's thinking through the whole range of outcomes, different probabilities, different potential, multiverse type of thinking, right? Like this branches off the timeline Loki example, right? Like, we have to be willing to think about a lot of different possibilities, but also weigh them correctly, get the probabilities correctly. It's a challenging thing, but it's a good reminder to not put too much weight on any one thing.
Yeah, ultimately, that's why, a great example of why you don't just take your projections and boom, those are your rankings, right? Because you're not going to just draft off of projections. Yesterday, I said to John Paulson that I feel like rankings are like the free bread at a restaurant. It's not even an appetizer. It's just, all right, this is a thing, and it's barely the intro to the course. Like, I wouldn't even say it's as satisfying as like a damn good appetizer. I would say projections are, they're like the Yelp review or the Yelp to me, the Yelp pictures.
Yeah.
I don't care as much about the reviews as much as I care about, do the pictures of the food look good on Yelp? Big Yelp guy over here. Yelp, hit me up. Let's get a sponsorship going here. The projections are the Yelp review to see if you even want to try like that restaurant, if you even want to go there, right? What are your projections look for the team, like for the team level, the player level, whatever. All right, maybe I'll go check out this restaurant. And so again, that brings us back to the free bread, the rankings. Ben, I definitely have a complicated relationship with fantasy football rankings, I'll put it that way. How do you approach taking your rankings and your projections and the results of those, putting them into rankings, and how do you advise your readers and subscribers, like, hey, here are the rankings. What do we do with those?
Oh, I hate rankings, but I mean, that's just, that's part of it.
And that is why you're here on rankings week, buddy. You mentioned Rich Rebar last year. He was here for rankings, for rankings week. And we kind of trashed rankings for like 45 minutes. But anyways, continue.
I mean, the big part of it is like there's always going to be a subset of the audience that's going to be the biggest thing they interact with from your content. And it's really that stresses me out as somebody who totally really cares about my subscribers. And I want people to have my actual opinions when they're on their draft, you know, on the clock during their draft. I want the guy at the top of the list to be the guy that I'd be considering. In every case, that's my approach to rankings. That's the bar that I set for myself, which is an impossible bar to get to. Everybody has slightly different league types and all that type of thing. And so I do it as a tiered based thing, and I try to provide as much context as I can to subscribers and write about all that stuff. But like you're saying, that's the main course for a lot of people. It's, you know, I love the point that it's just the bread, but that's all they want to eat. That's all they're going to dip into.
Full. Hey, people get full on that bread every time. If you've never gone to a restaurant and eaten way too much free bread and you're, oh shoot, do I even want dinner? You're a better person than me.
That's exactly right. And they're like, okay, what about, you know, this guy versus that guy? You have this guy ranked. And I'm like, man, half the time I get asked that question, it's testing whether I even want to stand behind it.
Because
it's very, very difficult to get your projections of 200-ish players exactly ordinarily right where you would want them at all times. In addition to the fact that stuff is constantly changing. As we talked about at the top of the show, Josh Downs has a high ankle sprain today. I had to go to my rankings and go, man, I got to move him down, but I still really like the profile. So how far do I move him down? What am I, you know, and then I have to rethink the whole thing, the whole range of outcomes. Well, is, you know, guys that get hurt in August often have that linger into the year. High ankle sprains tend to linger. This is a really tricky situation. At the same time, I really like his potential to break out. If he can get healthy for the second half of the season, it's only August 7th. So you start doing the whole thing and it's like, man, I got to figure out a spot where I would put him. And then some of the time you think you put him in a really good spot relative to market expectation or this or that, or you think you're high on a guy and then the feedback you get is like, why are you so low on this player that you're actually you were intending to be high on, and you're like, well, guess I got to go back to that and figure out how I could get him higher in my rankings, because I do really like the profile and I certainly wasn't trying to give the impression with this ranking that I'm out on this guy. I got that with Jaxon Smith-Njigba this offseason already, where I've been talking favorably about him. I'm pretty excited about his potential. And then I thought I ranked him pretty aggressively relative to at least like the underdog ADP and the stuff that I was familiar with. It seems like it was a little bit light for some people. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to go push him up higher. I mean, I want people that are losing my ranks to be drafting this player that I'm in on. He's somebody that I like this year. So it doesn't mean that I always will create rankings. It doesn't mean that I'm out on rankings as a tool. I obviously understand that for a lot of people, this is a hobby and it's their, you know, some years they're going to have more time than others. And if they trust you as an analyst, totally, they want to have that short version of like, you know, this is good enough for me. I don't have time to read all the analysts or analysis or be in on it this year to the same degree. But it is a really challenging thing as a content creator to make. And it doesn't capture, I mean, the hardest part for me is that like round 10-ish range at running back, where you start talking about these guys that are like, have volume but no upside versus the Blake Corum types, where it's like, yeah, they probably don't have much of a standalone week one role, but there's all this upside. And so how do you rank those guys around each other between like early season and late season projections, floor versus upside? It's just a mass of running backs at that point. They're a tricky thing to really dial in.
Yeah, it's a great way of saying it, that it's kind of a shortcut way to like get, what is Ben Gretsch's opinion? What is Matt Harmon's opinion? If I just look at the rankings, I think you do have to accept them if you're using it, and that's the only thing you're using, which I'm with you, man. I totally understand. You know, I jokingly said to somebody on Twitter the other day, they asked me like, hey, do you have any breakout wide receivers, sleeper wide receivers this year? I'm like, I think I jokingly said, and I was totally meaning to be joking. I was like, I'm on 8 podcasts a week now in August. I have a website. I write articles for Yahoo. Like, I think you could probably find him somewhere. And you know, somebody replied immediately like, well, not everybody has time to listen to 8. I was like, I totally, totally, totally understand that. Like, I sympathize with that. Again, I welcome people at the top of the pod back in August. Welcome back. Congratulations on your normal life. You don't just think about football all the time. That sounds wonderful. So again, you can use these things, but they are just shortcuts, right? And ultimately, if that you're just trying to get to the destination because you don't have time to consume every single piece that you have on stealing signals. You don't have time to consume every single reception perception profile. Totally get it. But, you know, this is, it is a limited way of conveying that information. I'm with you. The hardest thing I struggle with is I don't ultimately care about, you know, my rankings being accurate or whatever, but trying to paint a realistic picture of how the season might play out while also trying to flag plant players is the most difficult thing I think to do in rankings. Because yeah, I'm with you. I want people that are using my rankings last year to draft Nico Collins, but how do I also try to be realistic with my overinflated opinion of Nico Collins versus just like, hey, this is a totally unknown situation with a rookie quarterback, new coaching staff. Do they even like Nico Collins? Like I like Nico Collins. I don't know. These are very, very hard things to weigh when you're doing rankings. So I think that's a good table setting conversation for rankings, projections. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Ben, we're going to talk about what fantasy analysis gets wrong right after this. All right, Ben, I'm excited about this conversation. What fantasy analysis gets wrong? And I love the first point that you brought to the table here, which is thinking things have to be present in past data to predict into the future. You hinted a little bit at this, trying to use past data to project the future and why that's a little bit faulty. So sort of expand on those thoughts here.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we set the table in the first segment and we're talking about projections and rankings, I think a really big part of that point is that you can't know a lot of the future or the way the season's going to play out. The way that I always shorthand it is that the NFL is chaos. The NFL seasons are chaos. I think at this time of year, one of the big mistakes that people are making is they're trying to predict basically week one. They're reacting to every camp report. And it's like, this is, yeah, I mean, this guy's ahead right now in camp, but that doesn't mean that that's, I mean, what happens for week one, you don't win a prize for predicting the depth charts in week one, right? Like week one is the least important of our concerns. Ultimately, what we're trying to also project is how over, you know, a 3-4 month NFL season, the depth chart is going to evolve. Who's going to be able to take a chance, take advantage of opportunities that we don't even know exist yet because of injuries or other situations. And so a lot of the time it's like, okay, there's so much uncertainty that I just want to bet on talent profiles and guys that will, the cream will rise to the top. But that doesn't mean you can completely ignore the rest of it either. And so I do think the market is moving towards this idea that past data is the most important thing. If we look at you know, what these guys did statistically in the past, we know who they are. And so, you know, that's how we can predict them in the future. One of the things that I see a lot is, you know, you can't be as high on player X or player Y because they haven't done it before. Two great examples of this that I've seen this offseason multiple times are Garrett Wilson and Drake London, who are both going in the late first, early second round. Garrett Wilson has had very different quarterback play than we expect in the future. We talked about that a little bit already. Drake London, you mentioned the Atlanta. When I go do the Atlanta projections, when I look at the market-based stuff, their win total expectations, a reasonable pass rate for them relative to them being dead last in pass rate over expected last year and second to last the year prior under Arthur Smith, just putting them somewhere in the average range, not saying that they're going to be particularly pass heavy, but when you have a quarterback like Cousins, you're going to probably throw a lot more. And then also adding in the element of like the catchable target rate stuff we talked about a little bit, but like Kyle Pitts has been one of the lowest catchable target rates the last couple of years, for example. These guys didn't have great quarterback play. Kirk Cousins comes over from Minnesota and he's good at that particular stat. He's going to get his guys catchable targets. You're going to be in a completely different situation. That's where the projections can be a tool, right? But at the same time, they're not going to be the only answer. But, you know, I've heard that Drake London has not seen more than 120 targets in a season. So how can you project him to have this breakout year? And I'm like, if you're not projecting it for him, you're either saying that the market is very wrong on Atlanta's win total this year, because there have been very real changes in their offense and all of this stuff. They do have a very easy schedule. If the market's very wrong on that, you can go place a direct bet on in the prop market if you want to, if you're that confident that they can't be a different type of team. Or you're saying that it's, if it's not London, that it's Pitts or it's Darnell Mooney or something. But this is what the projections are sort of telling us. At the same time, there's a lot of, you know, being way too focused on what the data, you know, has already said, I guess. And so, I mean, I wrote it in our notes that there's a lot of double counting. You know, there's good stats. There's advanced stats that are useful and helpful. But when you start to get into multiple overlapping advanced stats that all pretty much boil down to like, this guy has a lot of yards and touchdowns, like that's just, they're telling you the same thing, but we're acting like they're telling us three or four We're acting like they're telling us the same information three or four, or they are telling us the same information three or four different ways. We're acting like they're telling us three or four different things. Like they're all different data points, but ultimately we are dealing with small samples. I mean, that's a huge part of the data element. It's a huge part of understanding where things go in football and how things can evolve and change. Is that what we've seen in the past is 17 game seasons. They're not massive, massive samples. There are guys that do bounce back from bad seasons or, you know, come back from good seasons and can't keep it up. We talk about efficiency regression and those types of things. Yeah, it's a very important thing to remember that we are predicting future outcomes. It's not to argue that we should ignore past data, because I'm very data heavy in my work, but it is a reminder that you can't predict 2024 based on 2023 data. The type of stuff that actually becomes the outlier types of league winning outcomes that we want to find in fantasy football, they're not present in the past data.
I want to go back to the Drake London point, because like I totally get it when you're on the clock this year, and especially if you haven't been doing best ball drafts all summer or whatever, you come into your draft this year and you see like Drake London has an ADP in the same neighborhood as Mike Evans and Deebo Samuel and all these guys that have done it before. I totally get why that is difficult to kind of grapple with for a casual fan or even like a pretty dedicated fantasy football player. I had Drake London on a team previously and it didn't go well. This is where it's difficult to sort of juggle the, hey, this is a new thing. And okay, well, if somebody's probably benefiting from this staff and, you know, the new coaching staff, new quarterback in Atlanta, if it's not Drake London, is Darnell Mooney having a big season this year? I love that way of thinking about it. Just again, trying to get the math to come together here. That makes a ton of sense. I want to go back to the point that you make about like double counting stats, because I think about this a lot. I think about this all the time. And the small sample sizes, like this is all Dontavian Wicks, super efficient, a small sample size. This is all small samples, man. I mean, you can do a sample of the Packers offense in the first half of the season and the second half of the season, the games with Christian Watson, the games without Christian Watson, the games that you thought Jordan Love was good versus the games you don't think it was good. So it's difficult to sort of nail down on these sample sizes. But when you talk about double counting stats, and even some of them are good stats, can you think of examples of specific metrics or other specific situations that maybe that applies to this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the wide receiver stuff is really interesting, and you know, you do a lot of great work with wide receivers, and we could talk about that side of it. The one that comes to mind immediately when you ask that of a different example and how it is sort of double counting one data point is Anthony Richardson, who unfortunately got hurt twice in four games last year and only played a third of both of those games, roughly about 33% of the snaps. So he played about 2 2/3 games because he had two other games that he started and finished. And in those 2 2/3 games, he ran for 4 touchdowns, which is a massive rate. If you extrapolated that, a lot of people like to do the pace stats. If you pace that out, it's like 24 rushing TDs. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure that would be a record for a quarterback. What I keep hearing about the issue with Anthony Richardson that you have to grapple with that is really lofty. I think QB5, QB6 ADP, depending on the site that you're on, is not whether the rushing upside exists. It's whether his passing numbers can come along enough to make him a true break the sport type of thing that we know the mobile quarterbacks can break stuff, but they have to have some element of passing. Like when Lamar Jackson did it the first year, his passing TD rate was massive and he had 30 plus passing TDs in addition to the like 1200 rushing yards that he had. And so there's this balance. And with Anthony Richardson, when I start talking about the advanced stats, I see people talk about, I saw the other day a reference to fantasy points per snap, I think it was, which is a really important metric if you look at it in the aggregate. But for Anthony Richardson, it's really just restating the same stat of like, well, how much can he maintain 4 rushing TDs over 2 2/3 games in a larger sample? Because we do know it's a very small sample, right? And then we know that the impact of 4 rushing TDs in fewer than 3 games worth of snaps is going to dominate all of any metric that looks at fantasy points, like a fantasy points per snap metric, anything that looks at, you know, his points per game. I think you could look at even some of his advanced metrics like his designed run rate or his scramble rate. They were high for his first few games of his career. But again, you get back to the small sample element. And a lot of this just all goes back to Anthony Richardson in a very tiny sample last year, rushed in a way that if we could lock that in for every game the rest of his career, he'd be the greatest fantasy quarterback of all time. He rushed for a bunch of yards. He rushed for 4 touchdowns. And he's big and he's super fast. And I know that people are
are looking at that and going, he's going to run for 15 TDs like Jalen Hurts and Josh Allen did last year. And I think that's very much in the range of possibilities. It's worth noting that both of his injuries last year, the concussion and ultimately the shoulder that cost him the year, came on designed run calls. And more to the point, all of that positive stuff on his profile relates back to this very small sample of the rushing data, when I think the big question you have to ask yourself for Anthony Richardson goes back to the passing stuff. And there's not a ton that we gleaned in that very small sample on his passing stuff. There was some positives. And he was a really young prospect. He was a 21-year-old rookie. He came out after 3 years and had only started the 1 year. And so we are talking about a guy that we should expect to develop. And the big conversation around him going into last season was, maybe he'll be raw and develop into this player long term. I think there's still some questions that you need to answer when you bet into, you know, Anthony Richardson at his point. And all of the counters that I've heard about him, if you think through what the actual stats are telling you, like a fantasy point per stat or per snap stat, it's essentially just getting back to this exact same thing, which is, yeah, he ran 4 touchdowns in 2 2/3 games. But I can tell you right now, just looking at the touchdowns and the overall sample, I can't project him for 20 plus rushing TDs. The question is he going to have 8? Is he going to have 15? Because if he has 8, that's good, but it might not be good enough at his ADP if he doesn't have big passing numbers in addition to that. And obviously you have Jonathan Taylor back and healthy and paid and hopefully happy. Maybe he has a lot to say about the rushing TDs in this offense. And so that's one of those situations where you can cut and parse a lot of different advanced data, but it's always going to go back to the one, you know, just the touchdowns, the rushing TDs, right? And so that can be true for a lot of different types of players. And so you're trying to figure out, I think, the real thing that drives some of the advanced data, why you're seeing what you're seeing. And a lot of the times it just gets back to the really simple stats, frankly.
This is so good because I'm sure you feel this way as a content creator. I know I feel this way as a content creator. And I think this is just human nature. We tend to want to just over justify our stance on things. And I think a lot of the way that we do that as fantasy analysts is giving you a lot of data to go along with something. And, you know, you see this on Twitter. People put these lists out of like Anthony Richardson in the first 4 games was he rushed for this many touchdowns. He had this many points per dropback. He had this many points per snap. He had this many points. It's like, well, you said the same thing now 4 times, but you've just said it in a different way. And look, like that does get that is good for content. If you can sit there and list off multiple things, It looks good. That's a good list, but ultimately you've just said the same thing over and over again. But it tends to be like, shoot, that was 4 really good stats.
Right. I'm blown away.
Man, I mean, he checked 4 boxes, but ultimately, no, it's just, you know, one. And people do this with, people do this with receivers with me. It's like, yeah, he's a good reception perception profile. And he had this many yards per route run. It's like, well, you've actually just said the same thing twice, which is
right.
This guy's good at football. Yeah. Like he's right. Good at football. Now, sometimes I will say like, yeah, he had a good RP profile, but a bad yards per route run. And we can explain that somewhere in the middle there as to what the difference is. But ultimately, again, using the stuff that I'm charting and then using advanced data to say this player is good, we're saying this player is good 3 times, which doesn't make him 3 times better. It still just makes him as good as he is. And I think you say this in a really good way where you talk about misapplying the aggregate to the specific when we're talking about data. And I love this as a concept with advanced stats because, you know, we do have these boxes and thresholds that we want players to check. We want them to fit into this certain boxes. And I'm not going to just keep bagging on yards per route run here. But, you know, you see this a lot when we talk about rookies. And, this guy crossed this yards per route run threshold, which is in this group of players, which feels really good to see because this is all a bunch of good players. I think about guys like Chase Claypool and Christian Watkins and like Rashee Rice from years prior. It's like the way those guys did it versus the way like Justin Jefferson did it or Odell Beckham did it is really, really different. So is that sort of I'm asking you here, is that sort of what you're talking about? We're talking about misapplying the aggregate to the specific or am I not getting the point here?
No, I think that, I mean, that definitely, broadly, it's like the type of fantasy analysis that looks at the whole sample and says, okay, this tells me something in the aggregate, looking at all of the wide receivers, here's the trend, and then wants to apply it to a specific data point that often like doesn't belong in that cohort or is right. So like, and then, and in some cases, when we look at the aggregate data, because again, it is small samples all the way down, we are just taking out all of the variance in the individual profiles. So one of the examples, when I wrote a piece recently called Misapplying the Aggregate to the Specific, one of the examples I got to at the end was this idea of age curves. And the great Blair Andrews did an awesome piece at RotoViz about this recently, but he shows how you have the aggregate age curve, and then he shows the individual players and how each of their scoring, just little like, you know, unlabeled graphs, but just showing how they go up and down. And one of the things that I'm going to end up writing this offseason, and I've had in the back of my mind, is this idea that how short NFL player peaks are is sort of the key to the whole thing, where we talked about it earlier, and you mentioned this idea that you need to see something before, like when we're talking about the Drake London and those other receivers, a lot of people want to have seen it. But a lot of times by the time you've seen it in the NFL, the peak can be over. I don't think people really realize that a lot of times the peak is like 3 years, man. It's really short. And if you go study players that you remember from the, you know, the past, I mean, we obviously celebrate the Hall of Famers that were able to be the true outliers over lots and lots of years, but even they have ups and downs in their career. Like one of the great examples, Larry Fitzgerald, this guy did it for 20 years, but he had this little stretch early in his 30s where they had really bad QBs in Arizona, and it looked like he was done. And then he came back and
John
had
Skelton, baby.
Yeah. And then he came back and he had multiple 100 catch seasons after that. And you're like, oh yeah, Larry Fitzgerald's the GOAT. And this was just a blip in his scoring profile. But if you look at an age curve, that's like, it looks very different for his scoring compared to the aggregate. And so the ways that we apply these things, I mean, a lot of guys have peaks that just happen in their first few years, right? Like I think of Juju Smith-Schuster when I think of this point, where it's like, this guy was awesome, you know, early in his career. And then that was his peak. That was it. Like injuries kind of sapped everything that he had. There's other guys that don't peak until late. Like Raheem Mostert led the NFL in touchdowns last year. And this guy's going in like the eighth round in most leagues. That's never happened. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm just going to declare that if it's never happened in fantasy football history, that the guy who led the NFL in TDs is going in, you know, the eighth round. That seems crazy.
It sounds right. I'll take it. It sounds right.
The only reason that could have possibly been true is because he's 32. But the fascinating stat on him is he had 19 touchdowns career prior to his 21 last year. He's in his peak. This is Raheem Mostert's peak. We're not clinging to a 32-year-old back trying to get something he did back at age 25, because this guy wasn't even producing in the NFL at age 25. He had been kicking around a special teams guy. I'm not saying that he's definitely going to be better than other age 32 backs, but I am saying the aggregate age curve data is not something I really want to apply to Raheem Mostert when it comes to other 32-year-old backs who typically have started to see some efficiency decline and a lot of other things. But in Mostert's case, he's literally coming off the best season he's ever had. And really his first really good season in San Fran was about age 29. Like this 3 or 4 years, I'm more willing to bet on a 32-year-old back when he had 21 touchdowns last year. Sort of the point that I'm trying to drive home here. It's betting on him to not hit an age cliff rather than an age curve. And so we could go into the age curve type point. There's a lot of other examples of this type of thing. There's the draft strategy stuff. I wrote in our notes some stuff about the running back dead zone, which I've done a lot of work on in the past, where I see people just grab all the ADPs in the dead zone and then aggregate it, you know, a point scored versus expected points, and then say either the dead zone exists or it doesn't exist. The research that I did initially on that while I was at CBS years ago was focused on the actual, well, it was a 10-year sample of those running backs, and then it was focused on the actual profiles. And for some of them, the ones that actually did hit in the dead zone, for almost all of them, the big trend that was clear when you looked into the specific parts that made the aggregate trend, it was the young guys that the market hadn't bought into yet. It was either rookies or second-year players or things like that. Because of that very specific note and understanding of what the dead zone was, I was advocating last year to draft players in the dead zone because there was a group that included Breece Hall and Jahmyr Gibbs. It also included some guys that didn't hit, like a Javonte Williams, a Travis Etienne, another one that hit. There was this group of names that weren't your typical dead zone back. They weren't propped up by like volume projections. They were young, sort of unproven talents. The thesis with those types of players, and you see this in the past dead zone data, is once they hit, they become first rounders in the future. They're long-term perennial stars going forward. Breece Hall and Jahmyr Gibbs are great examples of that. And Travis Etienne to a lesser extent, but the market's still not totally buying into him. Once they linger in the dead zone year after year after year, that's when you start to say, well, the market really doesn't buy that this guy has true upside. And the market tends to be right about that once they're 3 or 4 years into their career, and we know who that player is. So it's typically you want to bet on dead zone profiles when we don't know who they are yet. Well, that's a very specific takeaway from the aggregate data that got me on the dead zone last year. Well, a lot of what I'm seeing this year is that because the dead zone hit last year, there's no dead zone anymore. But I don't see the same types of profiles there this year. And when I go again, look at the aggregate trend, but also look at the specific profiles, I kind of think the dead zone's back this year, personally, based on the research that I've done, that the guys that truly hit, like the Breece Hall and Gibbs, aren't priced in the dead zone anymore. And you don't have more young guys like that that are there. Instead, it's some guys with fragile efficiency profiles and a lot of projected volume, like a Rashad White to me is a classic dead zone back. I like the guy as a receiver, but he's had some really poor rushing metrics. And that's one of the telltale signs of dead zone backs. He's propped up by his volume and his expected role, but he can't actually add a lot of efficiency to that to where he can be an elite producer. Because to get those great running back seasons, we need guys to be efficient on their roles too. The good roles, but efficiency on top of it. That's just another one of those examples. You can look at the aggregate data, but you do have to peel back the layers of the specific data points to understand what these trends are actually telling you.
Yeah, from an overall trends perspective, it makes a ton of sense because every year is different. And like we know what ADP is. It's mostly just a representation of how last year's fantasy season went. Both from specific players, there are different instances like the Drake Londons, the Garrett Wilsons that we mentioned. But by and large, the way it played out last year is the way it's going to be reflected in ADP. But we inherently know that the NFL doesn't work like that from a year-to-year trends perspective. And even with individual players, you know, I was writing about Derrick Henry this morning in my draft day blueprint piece. And part of me, and I've said this on the show, is just very suspicious of the fact that as a fantasy industry as a whole, we seem to basically just all be accepting that a 30-year-old running back with a ton of mileage is going to be A-okay because he's in the Baltimore Ravens offense and he's uniquely, it's like that is a profile that we would typically want to fade. At the same time, Derrick Henry is not a typical running back, right? He's not he's already not built like an NFL running back. He's not a normal NFL running back. So that I think is something that I grapple with all the time, where it's just as a, like a natural contrarian that wants to raise my eyebrow at everybody agreeing on something, that's sort of hard to juggle. But also to me, where the way I try to analyze players and situations is just I try to take it by a player by player perspective, because I think Puka Nacua is not every second year receiver. You know, all the other guys are different. It's difficult when you start to sort of try to group players together as second year receivers do this on average. Well, not all those second year receivers are going to fit into that bucket. And it can get kind of honestly, Ben, a little overwhelming and a little, your head can start to spin by trying to think of all these specific examples. But to me, that really is where the crux of most fantasy seasons are made. And you made this point in our notes that the NFL is chaos and, you know, we're not going to be right all the time. I've said that a lot on this show. In fact, like we try to make these perfect teams where we try to nail all these right picks. But the reality is most of your picks are going to suck. It's just trying to get the ones that really make a difference ultimately in each individual fantasy season.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, this gets back to that idea of like we're predicting the future and we're looking for outliers. We're looking for these players that are going to do things that the past data never told us was possible. And so, you know, you asked a little bit ago what fantasy analysis gets wrong. And in some respects, and I certainly don't mean to overstate this, but it's almost like everything. Like we're all just constantly talking about these little micro edges when we should be solely focusing on the extreme outlier potential type situations. Rather than talking about the 50th percentile or median outcomes, we should be talking about the 95th percentile and above, which is very unlikely, but trying to dig into these like little differences in the, you know, those really extreme edge cases, like, well, how big is this guy's upside? What really has to happen? How high can his scoring get? And how likely can it be to occur? What does it take to occur? Because you really are truly just looking
let's take it back to 365 days ago, Ben. If you came on this podcast, or you went, not on this podcast, because this is a place of reasonable nature, but you went on Twitter and you said, let me tell you why Raheem Mostert is going to lead the NFL in touchdowns, you would have been laughed off the freaking internet, pal.
Or Puka Nacua is going to have 160 targets this year. Like, what?
Yeah, not even Puka Nacua will lead all rookies in receiving. Puka Nacua will lead all rookies in receiving ever. You know, yeah. And again, how do you possibly predict that? You ultimately can't, unless you do that with every single player, which then you're going to get everything wrong.
Right. And so that's the big thing, right? It's not a license to just not pay attention to any of the data or not try to make informed decisions or not look at the aggregate trends that tell you things about second year receivers, like you were saying. We still have to weigh all that stuff. Again, I'm somebody who weighs all that a ton in my analysis. And yet I also think it's overplayed in a lot of circles where it's, we're way too confident that because something hasn't been shown yet, it can't actually happen, when that's not what anything about any of these years that we've been doing fantasy football has ever told us. It's not just last season that we could give you these examples. We can give you these examples every year, and they're different every year. The Puka Nacua thing, last year's big trend was a rookie hitting in that massive way, a rookie receiver hitting in that massive way. He was a decades-long outlier in that regard, in the way that he did that. And every year there are certain types of decades-long outliers. Like, that's the real sort of, you know, reality of it all. A couple years back, it was back-to-back years, but it was Patrick Mahomes and then Lamar Jackson. And it was like, our buddy J.J. Zacharyson's late-round QB strategy couldn't have been more right on those types of guys. But it also changed things. Now we've had, because the NFL has gone through this period now where those guys are just the elite quarterbacks, we've had more of a trend of their, like, elite quarterbacks have gotten more pricey. Well, they certainly did going into 2023, because in 2022, we were better at predicting the stars, because the stars were the same guys, Josh Allen and Jalen Hurts and Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson. But then I guess in 2023, it switched back a little bit because you had CJ Stroud and you had, you know, so we relearned that lesson. All of a sudden, there's an MVP candidate coming from the late rounds again, and Brock Purdy is coming from the late rounds again. These things somewhat are cyclical, but they're not going to be the same thing every year, and you are going to have some ebbs and flows. And so that's one of those other elements where it's like 2024 is different than any of the past seasons anyway. Each season is its own like data point. Each outcome, like one of the things I've been talking about a lot with the run receivers getting a lot more expensive this offseason, is that we had a really rough run of running back draft classes from 2019 to 2022. You had a lot of injuries. You had some busts with first round picks like a Najee Harris or a Clyde Edwards-Helaire that just didn't become the players that we were hoping for. Fantasy managers are obviously not drafting those guys nearly as high as you would expect a prime aged former first round running back to be drafted. You have the injuries that have derailed guys like Cam Akers and J.K. Dobbins in that group. These are the dudes that should be 24, 25, 26-year-old running backs that are leading backfields with like huge workloads. And instead, you mentioned Derrick Henry. That's like our RB, you know, RB8 or RB10 is a 30-year-old back that we're like, well, he's from an even earlier draft class, but we're saying is, you know, still hanging on. Christian McCaffrey is our RB1, right? Like, Bijan and Breece are sort of the outlier, but it's not deep at the top of the position, just in part because the NFL didn't have a great run of the best profile staying healthy or hitting in meaningful ways. And so that changes, I think, how you would look at the trends from the last decade about early running backs or the running back dead zone or strategy relative to what 2024 is actually giving you. What is in the landscape in 2024? Another big difference in 2024 that I've said repeatedly is I think the top seven tight end profiles are stronger and deeper in terms of upside than we've ever had in fantasy. And I mean, I've been playing fantasy since the late 1990s. Tight end was not as impactful until, you know, the Gronk, Jimmy Graham. Like, you had Gates and you had Gonzalez before that. It started to get more impactful, but you only had a couple. And now we're at a point where you still have Kelce and Andrews and Kittle hanging on, but you have Trey McBride and Sam Laporta were two real breakouts last year. And you have two guys that haven't broke out yet, but I think you can predict a little bit of a breakout in 2024 in Dalton Kincaid and Kyle Pitts because of those situational things we're talking about, where I do think you have to get comfortable being willing to predict things that haven't happened before in some situations. And those are two that I'm willing to. And so you have these seven names and you're like, man, any of these guys would have been a top three tight end in most any other season I can remember. So any data or evidence I see on how the tight end six has historically done isn't really relevant to me when I believe that 2024, the tight end six is better than it's ever been in the history of any of this data. And so, I mean, you're going through, you know, all of these layers of things. And again, you are still using data and information. I'm obviously looking at all of the profile elements of those tight ends to make that declaration or to feel that way about those players. It's not just me guessing at something. But we then have to understand what a lot of the trends we are told about, say, how elite tight ends have performed in the past, or what it means that receivers are going this high, and how past data has shown certain things. Why would that maybe be different in 2024? And what are the trends that are actually going to define 2024 that we don't know yet? And that requires a little bit of a different type of thinking.
Such great stuff. And trying to find out what that next thing is really challenging. I love the point about the running backs because, you know, again, I'll reference the blueprint piece that I was writing this morning where talking about like high level view of running backs this year. You know, if you're not somebody that likes uncertainty with your fantasy picks, well, congratulations. You're not making any running back picks after the first round. Pretty much. Like, because right. I think you could go running back. I looked at just running backs that don't have first round ADP and at Yahoo, which at Yahoo is a little more running back heavy than some of the other sites. So like Jahmyr Gibbs and Jonathan Taylor both have first round ADPs at Yahoo. So throw those guys out. You just look at running back six to guys that are in the 32nd overall ADP. I mean, every single one of those players has some major piece of uncertainty to it. And by the way, it's totally fine if you just don't want to make a pick in that, or like you don't want to pick running backs in that range. I think that's fair. But then you have to ask yourself that question about the receivers: is do these receivers really belong in round two, or are we pushing these guys up because we haven't necessarily had that next running back? And is there a next running back out there? I think that's really, really, really difficult to figure out this year in drafts. And final point before we just transition here, you mentioned like JJ Zacharyson and late round quarterback, and how, you know, you could, Lamar Jackson was just so easy to see coming in 2019 was his first year starting.
Yeah.
It was just, he was a 12th round pick pretty much. And it was just easy to see coming that he was going to be a fantasy success. Was he going to be a fantasy smash? We didn't know that at the time because we didn't know that he would do what he did from an efficiency perspective as a passer, which is funny because that perfectly brings us back to the Anthony Richardson point that you made, Ben, which is we know Anthony Richardson is going to be a good fantasy, a usable fantasy quarterback because he's going to run. Even if we triple, freaking quadruple count the stats, we know he's going to be good right. because he's going to run. But we don't know if he's going to be a smash because of the lack of uncertainty, the lack of certainty about the passing. But now here in 2024, we have to pay, you know, QB5, QB6 right. for that because the market has caught up to that. Like the most
it
boring
knows that Lamar happened before Lamar happened. The market didn't know Lamar happened. But now that Lamar has happened, we were all aware of what that can look like.
And the fact that CJ Stroud has happened, too, I think has almost like gotten us over our skis now about rookie quarterbacks is what I'm concerned about this year. Like the Bears receivers are great. The Bears receivers rule, but it's a crowded room with the rookie quarterback at the helm. And I like Caleb Williams. I think Caleb Williams is going to be good. Most rookie quarterbacks are not good. Mm-hmm. Most rookie quarterbacks are so bad to the point that you probably shouldn't even judge what they do as rookies. Just did they survive? Great. Are they even a few ticks better in year two? Awesome. Like that guy's a hit, but we can't even really say that until year two. So it's really difficult with the rookie quarterbacks. And I think again, because we saw Stroud last year, I think that's going to inform our opinions about a lot of these guys where I want to take these Bears receivers, but I'm very terrified at the fact that I'm asking a rookie. I don't, again, strip the freaking name off the back of the jersey. I don't care who the player is, which is a little antithetical to what I said about being player specific before, but it's just tough when we know that these things are informed by what just happened last year. And then maybe we're over indexed on that outcome to when we're trying to project this year.
I absolutely agree with that entire point. But with the real cyclical nature of all this stuff that's so funny is I think you could also make the case that the rookie QB data is one of those aggregate to specific examples where Caleb Williams is stepping into a situation that
is not normal.
Right. All of those rookie QB examples that we have. So if somebody's going to go do it, I mean, if you have Keenan Allen and DJ Moore and Rome Odunze and even Cole Kmet, who I think is a pretty intriguing young tight end, you could make a case that his situation being different enough than what most rookie QBs have to work with maybe means that we shouldn't put as much weight on the past rookie data. So I have been a little bit in on Caleb for that reason. But I completely agree with your broader point, and I think it's a great one. I've been grappling with it with Jaden Daniels. I grapple with it with Anthony Richardson, who didn't play a lot last year and is still very young. And I'm kind of thinking we're almost getting like a redo rookie season in that regard. Certainly, there's a lot of optimism about what Drake May could mean for the Patriots. I think that one is you know, in some circles is very similar to the Stroud thing where people are like, well, if Drake May is good, he's just going to elevate the whole offense. And I'm like, I mean, the way that Stroud changed everything for Houston was another one of those multi-decade type things where usually when we've seen other good rookie QB seasons, they have been like Justin Herbert had Keenan Allen, right? Or, you know, Baker Mayfield had a good early career. He had like a good Jarvis Landry and some other, you know, some other important pieces. So when we make these comparisons to when guys, Drake May from a profile perspective, because he's mobile and throws downfield, I've heard people compare him to Josh Allen. He struggled until he got Stephon Diggs. And then it was, right, that's when he took his step forward as a young player. So the situational stuff, I think when you start to get into the specific of why these trends exist, a lot of the times it's like, well, do they have a stud? And to your point about Nico earlier, I think that is, you know, probably a little bit understated on the Stroud stuff too, that Nico was just better than people realized because he had played with some really bad quarterbacks prior. So his data wasn't showing you, you know, that he was good. And this is something that you had uncovered in reception perception. And so, again, there's a lot of different important elements to consider when we're trying to predict something so unpredictable as NFL seasons. That's the reality. That's the thing we know, that NFL seasons are chaos. That is the foundational element we have to remember. And then we have to be willing to be open in the way that we think and willing to consider a lot of different possibilities. I would describe myself as an analyst as never really being sure of anything, which is probably crazy because I sound probably way more assured in this podcast than I actually believe. But if somebody makes a strong argument to me about something that I've been thinking about totally differently, I'm very often like, wow, I've been missing that. Like, you know, I'll just completely rethink it. I'm not going to dig my heels in because I've done that before, man, and I've been wrong. Like, I learned that the NFL is chaos, and that's the foundational principle, which is not a great foundation to have, chaos.
Well, no, but it's a good thing for us to stand on, as that as the foundation, even if it's a rocky one. But it's a good thing to stand on and remember that that chaos does rule us all. You definitely have my gears turning about this Bears situation as a pretty much unprecedented situation on multiple fronts. So that's a really good situation to talk through. We're going to take one last quick break. And when we come back, we're going to rapid fire through a few situations that the fantasy community might be wrong about this year right after this. All right, Ben, I want to hit on three situations from the ones that you threw out here where the community might be wrong this year. And I want to talk specifically about Jaxon Smith-Njigba and the idea about, you know, situations maybe over kind of inflating the data and things like that. So I'm actually in on JSN this year, too. So maybe this is just going to end up being confirmation bias time for both of us. But I'm curious about kind of where he makes sense in this idea about the data maybe telling us too much or not enough in situations.
Well, part of the reason I brought him up is I'm so interested to hear, you know, your expanded thoughts on it. I will say quickly that he broke his wrist last August. We were talking about the Josh Downs stuff. They had a week five bye. The first four games, he basically exclusively ran flat routes. And I know, you know, people will be like, oh, I've heard people make excuses for that. I watch all the games and I don't think I saw him run maybe more than like two downfield routes in any of these games. It was legitimately just like flat routes. And so if you go look at his ADOT in those games, it was all these underneath passes. After the bye, after his wrist was healed, he was actually wearing a wrap on his wrist as a receiver. After the wrist was healed, They were slow to integrate him, but as the late season elements came around, he did start to do a little bit more. He didn't hit in a major way at any point. I will note that he earned more volume than a number three has earned in Seattle since DK Metcalf was drafted by kind of a lot. He had 90 plus targets. I think the previous high was like 64. It's been just DK and Lockett in this offense, and that offense existed. Shane Waldron had been there in prior years. And so I kind of feel like, I don't think his rookie season is disqualifying for him to be good. People think he was a huge bust, but it's like he was coming into a tough situation. Some of us, like myself, were really optimistic about his rookie season, and it just didn't go great. He wasn't used particularly well, etc. The big thing that I'm pumped about, I'm a UW alum. They went and hired their new offensive coordinator is from the Washington Huskies, Ryan Grubb, and I've been asked about this a lot as a guy who went to Washington and follows the team. Their offense was really fun last year. It was basically spamming all of the fun elements of modern innovative offenses that you want to see. Motion, misdirection, multiple formations, so many elements. They were aggressive with tempo. They were aggressive on fourth downs. So many elements that are harder for defenses to react to, as defenses have been doing things differently over the last few years in the NFL. And I think there's a really big element to this that Mike McDonald is a new, young, constantly described as cerebral defensive head coach, went out and basically headhunted Ryan Grubb. He wasn't like going to get hired by a bunch of NFL teams. This was late in the process. He actually didn't get the UW job after UW's head coach went to Alabama. And so he was going to take the Alabama OC job and follow there. And then McDonald comes kind of out of nowhere late in the process and says, I want you to come be an NFL offensive coordinator, which, again, to me is more like a headhunting thing. It's more like McDonald, this smart defensive coach, saying, that's the way I want my offense to play because it's innovative. And so for me, JSN could go from really a coordinator in a system not using his skills correctly to potentially not just, you know, that regressing to something like average, but to potentially being in a situation where that's now elevating his skills, right? Where the situation's a plus for him. So I've used this concept of situation regression before, these things that we don't have data for, but we could still talk about regressing things. If we just put a percentile on it, maybe JSN was in a 20th percentile situation last year, and you would expect that to regress towards 50th percentile. But what if he gets to 75th percentile, right? Like, what if it's actually above average? And so those are the things from like a projection standpoint that I get excited about with JSN. But I'm really curious what you saw in your reception perception profile of his actual routes and whether he was able to win and all that stuff.
Yeah, to me, I thought his rookie season was so much better on film than any sort of stat presented it. You know, was it one of these rookie seasons that's just like elite? For sure. No, it was not. But typically, again, talk about trying to be cut and dry with data and simplistic look at it. Like, and to me, with reception perception all the time, I say I'm not trying to, I do offer like full, you know, full sortable data and compare everybody in the league. That's great. But to me, I want to use it within like individual player profiles. Like, let's look at what this guy was doing, what he was asked to do, and then how successful was he at doing that? And when you look at JSN, he checks two boxes I'm looking for, which is if you're going to be an outside receiver, I want you over 70% success rate versus man. He does check that box. If you're going to be a slot receiver, I want you over 80% success rate versus zone. He checks that box. Like, just historically, those have been good indicators. He checks both of those. To me, when we talk about it, mapping him into Ryan Grubb's offense, where he wins in that intermediate area, like some of his best routes from a success rate standpoint, wasn't getting thrown the ball on these routes, as we know, because it was mostly the flat routes and the screens and the, you know, the little underneath stuff. Out routes, dig routes, post routes, some of these more deeper and intermediate patterns, he has very high success rates, very high separation numbers on those. That's the Jalen Polk role to me. I think he maps so well into that. And not everybody's going to, you know, Ryan Grubb's not just going to take, like, this is the Jalen Polk position of my offense. But just from a conceptual standpoint, building those into the progressions and into the route concepts in the offense, I do think he's going to fit into that position. I do think there is a non-0% chance. I know people hate when you say that, but I think there's a non-0% chance that he could be the most productive receiver in Seattle this year. That's kind of where I just view the other two players, but mostly also where I think he could then take that next step in this particular offense.
Well, I'm just gritting ear to ear, so I'm pretty excited. You got me all hot and bothered, man. I'm going to be drafting way too much JSN after this conversation.
Same. Yeah, I mean, I definitely, he's we're talking about rankings. He's a flag plant player for me, where I have him. If you're using my rankings, you're going to end up taking him because he just fits in the area of the draft too, where I think he's after the wide receiver cliff. Like, to me, after wide receiver 30, 32 in my personal rankings, it gets very uncertain. You can poke a lot of holes in everybody's resume, but you're trying to get those areas right. He's one that I think is just worth taking there, because I think the whatever percentile outcome it is, I do think there's a higher ceiling for him than some of those other players that goes around there. Your third point here, the situations the fantasy community consistently gets wrong and might have wrong this year. You talk about, you know, he isn't good because the data says he isn't good. You threw out a lot of potential examples here. I want you to take one and sort of lay out the case for this player maybe being a little bit better than his particular data gives us.
Sure. Yeah. I'll mention Javonte Williams, who I have at the top of this list. It's because it's a little bit more health related than these ideas where like guys were in bad situations and you get a situational thing. But I mean, I feel like everything I've heard negative about Javonte Williams all offseason has been that he was really inefficient last year. And yet, this time last year, everybody was saying he had a multi-ligament knee injury and you can't draft him. And so the expectation actually going in was that was a great part. It was a huge element of what could happen in 2023. And then when that happened, we get back to this idea of double counting. Now we're saying that he's not good because he was playing through a multi-ligament knee injury. You listen to Sean Payton's quotes this offseason, and he's actually said, yeah, we had him out there last year, basically, but you expect the return to be more like year two from that type of an injury. And he had apparently reportedly asked Javonte Williams to cut some weight between, you know, early mini camp and training camp. And Williams apparently cut 11 pounds and Payton was really pleased with that. You have Bo Nix coming in there as a guy who had the low ADOT, but the really high accuracy, broke the record for completion percentage, taking over a Sean Payton system that loves to throw to running backs. Like it's the most perfect fit, I think, of any of the rookie quarterbacks, where like, I'm not even that high on Bo Nix, but if you put him in a Sean Payton system, like that's what he's good at. He'll take those underneath throws. He'll throw them accurately. He'll keep the offense on schedule, which is what Payton likes to do, which means a lot of running back targets. They were already led the NFL last year with Russell Wilson, which is something he had never previously really done. But under Payton, leads the NFL or the Denver Broncos end up leading the NFL in running back targets. Now you have Bo Nix. I think they could take the top off the league in running back targets this year. So if you play in PPR leagues, a guy like Javonte Williams is in this really great spot where he could catch a ton of passes. They will use multiple backs. That's the other element of Payton stuff. But the big part of the Javonte, where he's at and where he's priced in fantasy, the big part of it is that people are convinced that he's bad now. And I see it as a positive that Sean Payton used him in 264 touches last year in a year where he clearly was compromised. And yes, they did do a committee and they had McLaughlin and Perine both on the field, but those guys were at 107 and 103 touches. They were at 210 combined. Williams was still 50 touches clear of the other two guys combined in a season where he was clearly compromised. To me, that's Payton saying he does all the little things that I need a running back to do. He's good in pass protection. He can play all the roles I need him to play. And now they're talking about how he's sleeker. He's 2 years removed from the knee and all of that stuff. So again, the broader point is we can't just say he's bad because the data says he's bad when we already knew going in that was a risk. We're just double counting. I'm not saying he's definitely going to get all the way back, but I talked about some of the reasons I do like Javonte this year and where he's priced in most cases. You're just free rolling the efficiency coming totally. Back. You're just free rolling that. If he's actually what we saw prior to the injury, he's the best pick in fantasy, or at least one of the top running backs you can have in those middle rounds. So I'm pretty into Javonte being a guy where you just fade last year's data. Other than the workload, I actually think you look at the workload as a big positive.
98th overall ADP in Yahoo right now. Yeah, I mean, like most of the picks in that range are going to be terrible. They're pretty much like don't be attached to any pick in that range. So if you don't get Javonte Williams right, who cares? You move on. But I do like that take because it's just so frustrating with player injuries because you never know how that is affecting the data. And their overall output, except in this situation, we do know, like we knew going into the year that this was going to be a problem. So it's a great one to bring up. And I like that take because I made this joke a lot on the podcast, like about a month ago, I kept opening my phone and like every other day, every fantasy analyst I follow was like talking about the Denver Broncos running backs. I'm like, guys, we're really talking about the Denver Broncos running backs this much. But you're right, though. The reason for that is that if Williams is the guy that you're outlining here, he is going to end up being one of the best picks in fantasy. Final note here, Ben Gretsch. You talk about how the community is always too low on rookies. A lot about what you know you talked about earlier, which is that people feel they need to see it first. So I'm curious this year, are there any rookies that stand out to you as particularly mispriced, or is it just rookies as a whole, despite the fact that I mentioned rookie quarterbacks aren't good and sometimes rookie receivers they take a long time to get up to speed? Are there any particular rookies that you're into this year, or is it just kind of the advice to people, hey, throw some rookies in your draft plans and just see how it works out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is part of it, because I don't think we're particularly perfect at predicting who's going to be good as rookie. Like the way that I always think about rookies is they're kind of these wide band players, low floor, high ceiling, right? Like we don't know what they are. And like Justin Jefferson's rookie year, he was underrated and was a stud. He was going in like the 11th round or something. Garrett Wilson that year was very underrated. Didn't really pay off statistically because of some of the situational stuff. Obviously Puka Nacua last year is actually the great example where it's like no one thought he could be one of the top, you know, 10 wide receivers in football right away as a rookie. But that's what we saw. It gets back to this idea of like, you don't need to see it first. I wrote a piece last year that was called Get Comfortable Assuming Rookies Will Be Stars. Something like, you know, like I'm not saying that necessarily specifically making that assumption, but people are too afraid of being wrong on stuff they haven't seen before as well. It feels way more personal when you predict a rookie to be good and then he's bad, as opposed to like predicting like, you know, that aging running back to do something he used to do. I know when I think when I wrote it last year, I was talking about Zeke, and it was like, well, Zeke used to be a star. And then when he's not good, it's okay. But I was betting on him being what he used to be. And so it's like, yeah, I've already seen it once.
So, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. It takes the personal aspect away. Like, you don't have to feel like you missed on something. But anyway, to your question about a specific receiver that I think is really intriguing this year, I'll go with Xavier Worthy. I think he's a great example of a little bit of pattern matching with Sky Moore and Mecole Hardman, and even the way that they brought along Rashee Rice really slowly last year, where a lot of us are concerned that he won't play a ton early on. But he's a different player. He got more draft capital than any of those guys. They traded up in the first to get him as opposed to taking him in the second with all those other receivers. He's not just the fastest guy in combine history, but his production profile in college is pretty strong. I'd be really curious your notes on him from reception perception, but earned pretty good volume when you look at some of his college stuff. And then just the fact that the Chiefs offense needs that speed element and that vertical passing element for where they're at right now. Because we talked about this a lot last year, but Mahomes' ADOT was way lower last year, throwing underneath. Oh, Mahomes has become this checkdown artist. They clearly tried to address that, right? Marcus Valdes-Scantling wasn't enough of a threat. They went out and got Hollywood Brown, and they went out and traded up to draft Xavier Worthy. I think their offseason moves have told you they want this vertical element in their offense, which gets back to potentially Worthy playing early. Another fun note about him is when you go all the way back to him as a high school prospect, he was the second best recruit in his class by some of the scouting services. So this isn't like a late bloomer or something. This is a guy that was always expected to be an NFL wide receiver someday. The college numbers aren't perfect, but there's some concern about quarterback play. So again, I'm really concerned about your notes or curious about your notes on him. But this is one where I just feel like you have a team that's going to be first in the league in pass rate over expected, probably. They have been 5 years running. And they're going to be efficient at throwing the ball as well. So you start talking about the scheme and the coach and the roster and being able to think through what does it look like when it hits? Well, if I'm right on Xavier Worthy, it pays off in a huge way.
Worthy's tough because he's not even just like a normal Chiefs miss of a receiver or anything. Like he's a different player. Literally, he is a different player. He's also different than any receiver we've really seen come into the league that has this size, this level of production, this speed. He's the fastest player tested at the combine. And then I also, you know, I was kind of in the middle on Xavier Worthy. I wasn't as high as some of like the true dynasty bros who just look at the production and kind of the team adjusted production and stuff like that. But I also wasn't as low as some of the film analysts I know that really struggle with just the size and everything. Like, there's no question that the size shows up in reception perception data. Contested catch rate's too low. The press coverage success rate is low, which is to be expected. The dude is 165 pounds, and he doesn't move quite like a Tank Dell, who could play against physical press man coverage because he's longer, he's burstier. He's just a different type of player. Worthy is a little more linear, but that linear route running is pretty good in zone coverage situations when he can just outrun the entire defense. I mean, success rate on 9 routes and post routes are pretty big. Like, there's going to be a few moments, maybe once a week, maybe once every other week, where he just dunks on an entire defense because he plays with Patrick Mahomes. And how much volume is that going to amount to? I don't know. That's kind of the long-term question I have with Worthy. But for this year, I definitely see him paying back big plays for sure. I mean, I don't want to just say he's a great best ball pick and that's it, because I definitely think that there's more to his game, and maybe in the back half of the year he can be a guy that stretches the field horizontally for them as well as vertically. That's important too, as much as we are obsessed with the Chiefs deep pass. Like, can he stretch out the defense to the point that it's opening up stuff for other players? We never talk about that when players are taken by teams from a fantasy perspective, but they also take these guys with the imagination of what is Xavier Worthy going to do for Rashee Rice. So I don't know. He's a fascinating player that I don't have like a real strong take on, but I hear you to the point that like take a shot on a rookie like this, because he is just different than many of the other cases we've seen come to that team or really any team in football.
Yeah, I think that's really an interesting context. I guess on the volume stuff, I would hope that they'll do a lot of the gimme, you know, motion and jet motion tip passes and some of the swing stuff and just get the ball in his hands, you know, like a punt returner, basically, hopefully, because they've done some of that with, you know, Kadarius Toney, Mecole Hardman, some of those guys, but they still have those guys on the roster right now. So I'm with you. There could be some volume concerns. Another whole class of players I'll just throw in before I know we got to go, but the rookie running backs in the later rounds, people I think are really out on the day three backs. A lot of them landed in spots where they're pretty clearly the number two. And if you think that they're good, if you start to do this assumption and this thing where, like, well, they can be productive early in their career, you can get into like a Bucky Irving, a Marshawn Lloyd, a Tyrone Tracy. I think there's a lot of late round running. I think we'll see intriguing double digit round rookie running back production this year. I don't know exactly where, but that's a group that I'm trying to get exposure to in a lot of different drafts.
If the whole theme of this podcast is chaos reigns the NFL, which it does, and certainly should be the standing ground here for us in fantasy football, there's no better way to benefit from chaos than by taking some of these shots at the late round running backs, because no position gets hit by chaos more than running backs, and injuries and chaos on depth charts can create opportunity for some of these later round rookies. Ben Gretsch, this was absolutely electric. I know I learned a ton. You got me thinking about a ton of different things. We could do 5 spinoff podcasts on this, and I think it would be fantastic stuff. So I know the listener really enjoyed this. So tell the people out there where they can find more of your work, what you've got going on here as August rolls along.
Well, and I really appreciate you having me on. This is a fun conversation. It's really fun to peel back these layers of the onion of, you know, what you think is the right way to think about fantasy. So really, really fun conversation. Yeah, you can find all my work at my Stealing Signals Substack that you mentioned. It's just bengretsch.substack.com. I did buy the stealingsignals.com domain name, and I think that also redirects there, but I haven't actually really got that to work necessarily yet. You could try that as well if you don't know how to spell my name. Podcasts, Stealing Bananas and Ship Chasing are my two main ones. But yeah, that's pretty much it. The newsletter is where you get all my rankings, all my work, all my analysis. Again, that's bengretsch.substack.com. And thank you so much for having me on.
Of course, man. You are a perfect fit for what seems to be the annual episode here on Rankings Week of how nihilistic can we get about fantasy analysis, and does any of this matter? So it was a perfect fit. I really appreciate you doing it. And yeah, I could not endorse Ben's work more. Please make sure you're checking him out wherever you can. In the meantime, I would really appreciate it if you could like, subscribe, rate, review, all the things with the podcast. As I say, it would mean a lot to me. It'd be a personal favor if you left a 5-star review. It would not be a personal favor if you left anything less than that. It would mean not a lot to me if you left a 3-star review. You can also send us an email, fantasymailbag@yahoosports.com. Emails are nice, but the voice memos and the videos are even better. Please get involved with the show. More and more user participation as we get headed towards week 1. It's going to be crucial for this show. You can trust me on that. We roll on through Rankings Week tomorrow with new Yahoo contributor Tara Roberts on the players who need to have a career year to justify their ADP. No pressure. Until then, we're out.